got to keep in mind, these are the people that tend to get this disease are the go-getters. They're the senior corporate executives that are really high functioning, that a lot of times they're in great shape, and they'll say they jog 10 miles a day. I mean, it's just incredible what they used to do prior to getting this. They would have a flu-like illness, and then suddenly everything fell apart. They never recovered from it. And it was like a perfect storm of events that occurred. A lot, some of them report they had a lot of stress going on in their life at the time. Then they also had the virus come in, and the two things, along with other problems that were occurring at the same time, the body wasn't able to recover.
I'm going to wait until you've done this, but until I've seen what you're saying, but you're reminding me immediately of long COVID and the questions that we should be asking around long COVID. You know, who collapses to this virus? What are the conditions under which that happens? And where's the immune system? And is this really a disease? All of those are, to me, really questions that you're already raising, and I'm fascinated. So keep going.
Well, that's a very good point. And there is a lot of shared overlap and similarity between these two diseases. Long COVID patients do report a lot of the things we're talking about. The hope is that if we solve, a lot of people are working on what's going on with it, because they don't understand why this is occurring in patients, and some people are not able to get past this disease and not able to recover, even though now it's been going on 2 years for some folks. So it's starting to look like that they are developing a chronic condition from that initial infection. And the good thing about that is we know where it started. Like, yeah, we know in ME/CFS, it could be any infectious pathogen, virus. Usually they expected, a lot of them suspect Epstein-Barr, herpes simplex virus, you know, one of those etiologies that triggers it, but it's variable, right? And at least with COVID now, we know a lot about the virus. So we know at least that is an unknown that we don't have to deal with. And so the hope is that by solving long COVID, that will also help us to also apply or provide a template for what to do with ME/CFS, at least for some patients, but we'll be able to figure out what to do with them. It is probably one of the few silver linings in this pandemic. Unfortunately, it took a pandemic for this to become a prominent, you know, front center issue, right? And unfortunately, it's going to continue to grow. It's going to continue to get even worse as the virus mutates and as there's more exposure and more people getting it. And now even people with mild symptoms they're not hospitalized, but yet they're experiencing long COVID symptoms that are so similar to what the type of things you get with ME/CFS. So I'm interested in conducting studies that compare these two groups. And that's what we have put in a grant application to NIH to look at that, working with some collaborators at Northwestern University who do all the other modalities except for EEG. I do the QEEG, and then we, you know, take all that and combine it. So there's hope that will get funded. If so, then we will have the funds to do a large study and really go after this, figure it out once and for all. Because yeah, I think that there's hope that it's going to be at least leading to a treatment. That's the idea. There's no treatments for this disease. It's just basically patients, palliative care is basically all we have. And different patients find different treatments that work. It's a mixed bag. Hi, this is Dr. Mark Zinn with the Neurocognitive Research Institute, and you're listening to the Neuro Noodle Network podcast.
Welcome to NeuroNoodle's Neurofeedback and Neuropsychology podcast, featuring our neuropsychologist, Dr. Laura Janssens, tech whiz, neurofeedback legend Jay Gunkelman, and author of Neurofeedback and the Treatment of Developmental Trauma, Seaburn Fisher. Our goal is to provide information, promote options for better mental health. This is an all-star cast, and are more than happy to share their knowledge with you. Hey, my name is Pete, and today we have a very special guest, Dr. Mark Zinn, director and co-founder of the Neurocognitive Research Institute. But before we get to Dr. Zinn, we have some Patreon love to dish out. We'd like to thank our Patreon business supporters, as well as our show sponsor, Mary Tracy's Neurotraining Strategies offers a higher standard of EEG, QEEG education to EEG clinicians, technicians, and neurofeedback practitioners with convenient online BCIA and QEEG certified didactic courses. Hey, three things that our listeners and viewers can do to help us spread the word of neurofeedback. Number one, please subscribe to us on YouTube. That little action turns three people from learning about neuroscience and neurofeedback to 3,000. I don't know anything about algorithms. All I know is that little action right there makes the pie even larger. Number two, please give us a review on whatever platform you listen or watch us on. Hey, we'll take 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, but Seaburn will even accept 4.5. If you have the means, please support us on Patreon/NeuroNoodle. There are different levels in which you can support, whether you're mom or dad or a clinician. There's even an option where you can have your own Q&A with Jay Gunkelman. Hey, the support helps us improve the quality of our content. Okay, let's talk with Dr. Markson. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure to be here.
You're a good Chicago guy, DePaul guy. I'm in Chicago too. I don't know. I kind of talk funny, people say, or maybe you guys talk funny. Please tell us about your background and how you got the Neurocognitive Institute going.
Yeah, my late wife and I founded the Neurocognitive Institute in 2015. And we were interested in using QEEG to study an illness known as it's a long name, myalgic encephalomyelitis, chronic fatigue syndrome. So we just say ME/CFS. That's the name of the disease or the disorder that we were interested in studying. My background is that I was originally wanting to become a concert pianist, and I actually went into school in music school in piano performance. So I dealt with a lot of issues in psychophysiology dealing with performing on a solo piano recital, which is considered very demanding because you have to recite basically 186,000 notes in 75 minutes and try to get an error term down to near zero doing that, which is really stressful. Okay. And you're doing that before an audience. That's also stressful. And then you're dealing with the physiology, and that's interrupting the performance. So by that process of doing that and also teaching as well, because I was also a teacher and I still continue to work with students, that process made me become very interested in psychophysiology, which led into neuroscience because we were also interested in the brain and how the brain was changing in accordance with music learning. So we had our LexiCore NeuroSearch 24 system in the early 2000s. That was one of the first ones to come out. That was our first system, and we used that. We had a lab school, basically, with our piano students, and we found a bunch of interesting findings for that concerning music learning and performance, and we did that for about 10 years. Through the exposure to young children over time, particularly Marcy was susceptible to getting infections from them. There was transmission of certain pathogens, and a lot of it was viruses, things like that, that kids would bring in. Over time, Marcy developed the condition of, well, she was diagnosed with herpes and encephalitis, but that really turned into ME/CFS. And what we didn't understand at the time was what that meant. We had never even heard of CFS before. We didn't know what it was about. So we went, and it was a serendipitous thing that happened. We met Dr. Montoya, Jose Montoya at Stanford, through Marcy had actually been bitten by her cat. So the cat bite led to her meeting with this doctor, Jose Montoya, who is the head infectious diseases doctor at Stanford Hospital. They were worried about her hands because she was bitten on the hand. It swelled up like a balloon. And so he got in a conversation with Marcy. Marcy was telling her about her background. And he said, I'm doing this ME/CFS initiative, and I need, and you do EEG, and I'm really looking for someone like you to head up an EEG project within that. Would you be interested in doing that? And she says, oh, sure, that would be great. I would like to do that. So that's how we got introduced to ME/CFS. By the way, he did diagnose her later on with ME/CFS. So that made sense to me. So I got a firsthand view of what it's like to have this illness. I think you need that in order to study it. If you don't have a firsthand relative or someone that you live with that has it, I don't think you really grasp what's going on, because there's really a lot happening with this illness, and it's very hard to define. So
that may just clarify, you are talking about chronic fatigue syndrome. That's what people would call it regularly, right? It's the same.
It goes by several names. The CDC named it chronic fatigue syndrome. I think it was back in 1994. Later on, that name became questioned because it didn't really capture the illness. Prior to that, it was called myalgic encephalomyelitis. Patients liked that term. It sounded more like that was really what was capturing the essence of the illness. So there was a kind of a compromise that became MECFS, which is so much easier to say, of course, than the other thing. I mean, I don't know how many syllables that is, but then in 2015, the IOM committee at NIH decided to rename it to systemic exertion intolerance disease, so SEID. So, but nobody's really adopted that. Now, I mean, I don't think so. So we don't really discuss it, but it's not really about fatigue. That's the issue. It's about exertion and post-exertional malaise that happens when you engage in an activity for a brief period of time. There's no biomarkers. There's no the diagnosis is by exclusion. They use a case definition to diagnose this. So that means that you get ME/CFS is really an umbrella term for probably a lot of clinical subtypes going on in that you can't really get a pure sample of patients when you're studying it. The issue was that there was a lot of mixed findings in the literature, which led to a lot of confusion. There was some of the studies didn't have very good sample sizes. Some of the studies, they just weren't able to get the right group, a lot of them had in this sample, a subsample of those patients that did have findings, and they didn't have. The ones that did have findings were the ones that, you know, they tended to not have comorbidities. And so that was interesting, like, for instance, depression, because a lot of people think this might be depression. Depression has a lot of overlap, you know, and more and more we're developing new technologies to study this illness, but we haven't really figured out a great way to do this yet. And we haven't figured out a great way to study two things, cognitive impairment or brain fog, and then post-exertional malaise. Right, those are two separate things. They go together. What I did was Marcy and I did was from our EEG study at Stanford, we got some really interesting findings using qEEG and Loretta. What we were able to do was show that there was abnormalities going on in a really large patient sample, because they had a very large patient sample. It was a case control study, so we were able to compare cases with controls, and we were able to use qEEG Loretta to do that, and we found some really interesting findings that explained what was going on with their fatigue. And with that, we decided to, that's what led to founding this institute. That's really what led us to do it. We thought, okay, we've got something here, a modality that can actually, it has the capability of picking up on the subtle changes that are occurring in the brain, because that's really what's happening here. The patients are not being, with MRI, which has its own limitations, as we know, it's not able to pick up on the subtle changes that are taking place. QEEG, however, it has this high time resolution, right? It has the ability to look at the activity of the brain on the millisecond timescale, which is terrific, as opposed to seconds or longer with the hemodynamic responses, which, by the way, are not uniformly distributed across the brain, so we don't know for sure. The assumption was that certain areas of the brain were, you know, getting the same amount of blood flow, but it turns out that that's not necessarily the case. So there's a lot of issues with fMRI that prevented, and for this particular illness, it really made it difficult to really get any findings. And in the neuropsych test, by the way, they did neuropsych testing on people, and they didn't really score that much differently from healthy controls. The patients were able to, either the test didn't capture what was going on because they're just not sensitive enough. Once again, they were able to rise to the occasion and do it. I mean, most of these patients are actually very functional in some ways, even though they have the illness, they're actually able to perform okay. But the problem is that those symptoms change at any given moment and drastically, right? And so they could become very intense, very severe, and rapidly fluctuating. And they can't manage the illness because of that. So that's really what's going on. With the neuropsych tests, they weren't able to really identify things all that well. fMRI didn't have the capacity. So EEG, as it turns out, might be one of the great tools for this particular illness. It's just suitable for this. It's ideal for this type of problem, to solve this type of problem. So that's why we found the NCRI to really go after this. And we moved to from California to Chicago. I wanted to, you know, go to school here at DePaul University, and that's where I got my PhD. And I, you know, worked with Dr. Lenny Jason at the Center for Community Research, and we did some studies, and we were able to get some more interesting findings. That's what I'd like to share with you today at some point, is to go over some of the findings we got. You can see what I'm talking about and how this relates to Loretta, because Loretta is really a very powerful tool that is telling you that not only that there's an abnormality, but where the abnormality in the brain or the dysfunction, the dysregulation in the brain is occurring. And so I think it's really important that this modality, and probably used with other modalities as well, there will eventually be a way to identify patients that you don't have to just rely on case definitions. You're going to be able to differentiate patients. You're going to be able to see clinical subtypes. It's just a matter of getting enough patients in there in the sample and getting a large enough sample and having the funding to do it.
What does the great DSM-5 say about this condition? Is it something you can look in there and find it?
The DSM-5, well, this would be a cognitive impairment due to a medical condition, you know, and falling under that category. So it's not a psychiatric disorder, although there might be psychiatric comorbidity, which is understandable. If any one of us got a neurological illness, I imagine we'd be a little depressed about that.
Dr. Zen, you have something to share with us, I believe. What do you have?
I'm just going to start out with the Stanford study, because that's really what prompted us to really go at this. And it's just, these findings are really remarkable, I think. So I'm just going to let me just share the screen. This is a study we did at Stanford. That this was the project that with the original project, this was the result of that, this manuscript here. It was published in Biological Psychology. So the interesting thing about the brain in this disease is it seems like that it's underperforming or hypoactive. And that fits with other findings as well. It just seems that the brain doesn't have the same amount of energy in it, that the allocation of the energy is not occurring in the same way, or there's just something that is not able to restore itself. What we did, we did this study. This was involving 50 patients with CFS, ME-CFS, and 50 patients that were healthy. They weren't patients, they were healthy individuals, just doing a case control comparison. And what we found was, when we looked at the Loretta, we found a really interesting pattern in the delta band. And this is what it is. So this is a huge cluster. It's like 50% of the frontal lobe and 30% of the limbic lobe. Just looking all the yellow here in the frontal lobe of the brain. See, so in the prefrontal cortex, especially, where, you know, they're having a lot of dysexecutive problems going on. They're having problems with attention. They're having problems with decision-making. These are all the things that, and setting goals, that they're having all these problems that do align with problems that are occurring in the frontal lobe. Well, this is a cluster analysis, and that's why it's all yellow like that. But this is done, what this is to capture the, you know, the size or the extent, the pathology that's going on in the sample. And this is in the delta band, which is very interesting, because that delta band, first of all, delta, you know, excess delta is reported in, you know, just the EEG, conventional EEG literature. It's been reported in long COVID or COVID-19 patients that are hospitalized. And it's been reported in, if you look at, you know, chapters like in Niedermeyer and other EEG physiology books, you see there's a lot of inflammatory conditions do present with intermittent delta activity, frontal intermittent delta activity, things like that. So a lot of slow wave type changes going on in the brain. The problem is that in this disease, these changes are not visible to the naked eye. So you can look at the waveform. A neurologist can look at the waveform and say it's fine, and they'll give the report. They'll write the report unremarkable. There's nothing going on, basically. And the patients are disappointed because they feel like, well, gee, I'm having all these symptoms.
Yeah.
Well, how could this mismatch occur? And it's just because they're not using computers to quantify the changes that are taking place. It's to say that, well, if it's not visible, then it's not there. It's kind of like saying, well, I can look at the sky and I can't see the planets, so they're not there. I mean, you got to use some more equipment to get at that, right? I mean, that's why we have the space telescopes. We have, there's more in there. You got to dig for it. And and that's really what a point I want to make is that subtle changes occurring in the brain can have big ramifications. It could have big potential for a lot of symptoms, because these symptoms appear to be all brain-based that they're having. The symptoms are really prominent, which I'm going to go into. So this is interesting. We also found